I was invited to speak at a local Christian college outside of Knoxville. And by Christian, as I researched it, it meant they had roots in the Church of Christ, which is a big deal in Tennessee and Kentucky and places like that. And so I went, and it was like their convocation. So the whole student body is there, like 1,200 of them. And someone on their faculty had been reading books about liturgy and thought it would be very interesting to have an Orthodox priest come talk to them. And so they started off, and there was a lot of people there training for ministry of various sorts. And so it was like megachurch, right? It was evangelical megachurch and a rock and roll band, and actually a very good rock and roll band. And really amazing technology and TV cameras. I mean, they were training people for ministry in megachurch. And so there's everybody's got their hands in the air and everybody's singing and guitars are rolling away and stuff, and it's all done. And a guy introduces me, and out I walk looking like this. And there's, shall we say, a hush comes over the crowd. They bring their hands down, you know. and it's kind of like, what do you do? What can you say in a setting like that? And my talk was going to be on beauty. I figured, trying to think, what do I have in common with them? How can I talk about orthodoxy with a soft approach? Beauty. I mean, it worked for Vladimir's emissaries. We'll try it on the Christians of East Tennessee. Talk about beauty. And so I started off by talking about how good the band was. And it was a good band for rock and roll. And, and music and how wonderful all that was. And then I thought I would play my card to see if this was going to work. And I told them that back in a previous life, I had opened up for Alice Cooper and and the Birds. And it's true. It's funny. It's true. And one of the Birds is now now Orthodox, and that's all kind of fun. Yeah. Chris Hillman, yeah. And so you've got these things, but it was a long time ago in a land that was far, far away. But suddenly they were all happy again, and yeah, he sing us a song, do something beautiful. We'll do something different tonight. In these talks, I've kind of built this. It was interesting because we were going to do this as a Lenten retreat, and things happened. I don't remember. But anyway, it's been an odd couple of years, right? And many, many odd things have happened. But here we are, and so we'll be a little more Pascha-like. But what I build these talks to talk about sort of the place of playing hide-and-seek with God. It's important in our lives. He plays hide-and-seek with us. We play hide-and-seek with him. They're two very different things. But I want to sort of dig into some of this. And so tonight, as thinking of this one as kind of an intro tonight. I'll dig a lot deeper tomorrow. But in this talk, I especially want to talk about boundaries. Okay? Boundaries. The early chapters of Genesis introduce us to a theme that stretches throughout the scriptures. And that is when it comes to our relationship with God and God's relationship to us, we play hide and seek. He looks for us and we hide. We look for him and he hides. This dynamic is hardwired into the gospel, where in the gospel Jesus tells us, ask and you'll receive, seek and you'll find, knock and will be open. But for asking, seeking, and knocking to make any sense, there must be an unanswered question for you to ask. There must be something to be found for you to seek, and there must be a door that is closed for you to knock. And it's not possible to reduce all of this to some simple little thing. Or to this one thing alone. First, the stories are across the pages of Scripture, and they shift and change. Different settings, different characters. There's similarities, but differences. For instance, there's a huge difference between the question, where is God? You might hear that a lot. And God's question, where are you? Very different question. Although oftentimes those two questions do have a lot to do with each other. It was once suggested that the story of Christianity is not the story of man's search for God, but the story of God's search for man. That's been some time with this. I can't think of a single story in the scripture in which someone goes out in search of God. I racked my brains. I didn't quickly reread the Old Testament, and brush through the New to see, but I couldn't think of a time when anyone went out to look for God, in a search for God. And actually, it surprised me that there wasn't one, but it's just not there. And if I've overlooked something and you can think of one, be sure to point it out to me, and I'll correct myself. But for instance, Moses isn't looking for God when he sees the burning bush. That's not what he's doing. Abraham doesn't leave the city of Ur in search of God. He's going out probably looking for good land. Elijah isn't looking for God when he hears the still small voice. He's kind of being angry with God, but he's, or something. Jonah is definitely not looking for God when he sails for Tarshish. Just the opposite. I get that, by the way, when you get on a plane and you got your cassock on and you hit a few bumps in the air and people looking at you for, and support, and things, in fact, it was a bumpy ride up today and I was, tempted to pull out my beads and let them know that I was on the job, but I got to stop and tell jokes, but, I was on a plane back from Dallas once, and I was sitting in a row of three seats, and I'm in one seat, and there's this evangelical preacher boy from a seminary in Dallas over by the window, and there's this young blonde girl sitting between us, and she was white-knuckling the flight. It was not a bad flight, but she was clearly extremely upset, and she's just, holding on, and every bump of the plane is going, ooh, and the preacher boy looked at her and flopped his Bible, at one of those genuine leather-bound, seemingly preaching Bibles, and he said to her, he said, I want you to know that God's got a call on my life and this plane can't go down. I was impressed. And I turned to her, and I'm, again, wearing cassock, and I said to her, well, I want you to know that I've served God for 40 years, and he can take me anytime he wants. And she went, ooh, this is... But, it's always like, it's like Jonah, how do they know that you're not on the wrong plane, going in the wrong direction? It doesn't work well, Jonah's story, but... Jonah wasn't looking for God when he was running in the other direction and sailing off to Tarshish. Paul isn't looking for God when he's headed to Damascus. Adam wasn't looking for God in the bushes in paradise. He's looking for fig leaves, but he's not looking for God. But despite this, we are told to ask, to seek, to knock. So there's a human side to this story. It's not that we're just being told to be curious. Curiosity just doesn't rise to the level of what God wants from us. We get that occasionally. We'll have a curious seeker who will come to the church. Not that they're interested in Orthodox, they're just curious. It doesn't usually work. Those aren't very fruitful visits, but... you have to ask the right question if you want to get the right answer. But what we have within us is a hunger and a desire. Our desire, what the fathers call the eros, is a deeply essential part of this movement. I mean, it's essential, as in it is hardwired in you. That you desire God is not an option. You may not know you desire God, but you do. In fact, you desire God more deeply than you desire anything else. But most of the things that we waste our time on chasing with disordered desires are trying to put something else in the place of God. But the true hunger of our lives is our hunger for God, our desire for God. It's a deeply essential thing. So I want to suggest here at the outset, one way of understanding the movement of hide and seek is to understand that God is working to arouse our desire for Him. He's doing something. He is working to arouse our desire for Him. And it's His fundamental, which is to say, God hides in order to be sought. The purpose of God hiding isn't to hide. The purpose of God hiding is to be found. Okay, He hides so that we can find Him. Orthodox liturgical practice takes this movement of hide and seek into all of its structures. I've long noted that in Orthodoxy, if something is holy, we hide it. In fact, the holier it is, the more likely we are to hide it. I remember a friend of mine was telling me about this Orthodox monastery down south, and I was not Orthodox at the time. I was an Episcopal priest, but I knew this guy, and he had become Orthodox, and he was telling me that this monastery had a weeping icon, and I was just very interested. I was curious, and so I went down to check it out, and as I drove down, found the monastery, and I rang the little bell on the door, and this old monk, Father John, beard was down to his belly, Father John, and that was the first time I'd ever seen Orthodox monks, and I had not realized that they're dirty. Anglican monks, and Catholic monks too, tend to be very tidy and clean. Orthodox monks are kind of, you know, they're hairy, and they don't bathe a lot. You know, you go to Mount Athos. I mean, I never saw a washing machine the whole time I was there. It's kind of how it was. But anyway, old Father John is there, and I could see what he had had for lunch for the last week. It's in the beard. And he answers the door, and he had the personality of Eeyore, you know, in Pooh, the stories of Pooh. You know, he answers the door, hello, you know, and he invited me in, and he takes me back into the kitchen, and we're having a cup of tea together. And it's very nice, good hospitality, having our tea. And I said to him in the course of the conversation, I hear that you have a weeping icon here. Father John said, I'd prefer not to believe it. I thought, well, I've driven all this way. But I said, really? He said, well, it's not really an icon. I said, it's not? He said, no. It's a print. And I thought, okay. And then he said, and it's not Orthodox. I said, oh? He said, it was printed by a non-canonical group. And I said, okay. And then he said, but it weeps. What can you do? One of the lessons I learned from that, first off, that was a very interesting lesson on orthodoxy and miracles, was that in my neck of the woods, down in my corner of the South, I mean, if you had a miracle going on in your church on a regular basis, there would be billboards. There would be large billboards. I mean, we're still advertising the Civil War down there, and it's been over forever so long. But I mean, you know, and it's my early theological training, you know, was the Roman road, you know, posted up on little signs along the way. But, you know, here it was, you know, not only, you know, did they not advertise it, he was preferring that it not even happen. You know, but I just appreciated it. What can you do? It weeps. And there's something about that. If something is holy, we like to hide it. There's an instinct for this in the church that I think reflects a very ancient sensibility. As we'll see in these talks I'm doing, boundaries, this is part of boundaries, are utterly essential to our life, including our life with God. Without boundaries, it's actually impossible to know God. Both the boundaries he sets and the boundaries we have to learn to have. We do not have a story of God that is free of boundaries. Adam and Eve in paradise, for instance, are given a gift of boundaries. They're told you can eat of the fruit of any of the trees. No boundaries there. Just eat. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you may not eat the fruit from that tree. That's a boundary, because the day you eat of it, you will die the death, it says in Hebrew. But I would like to suggest that that tree, and people get kind of strange about the tree, you shouldn't have done that. And Father Daniel Biantoro, who's an Orthodox priest missionary in Indonesia, had a friend from a particular tribe in Indonesia who said God should have put paradise in Indonesia where my people are from. And he said, why? He said, because if the snake appeared, we would eat him. And so much for the fruit, eat the snake. But there was no boundary on the snake, but they didn't eat him. They broke the boundary God had given them. But I want to suggest that had God not given them a no in the garden, they couldn't have known him. This is the tree that lets you know the first and most important thing you need to know about God, and that is, you're not him. Yeah? That's something I learned from an old buddy. There's a guy who was, I had him painting my house. He was in AA, and he was in an AA group in this church I was serving, and he needed work, so I'm not going to do that again, but I hired him to paint the house, But anyway, he was, I remember him saying that. He's skeptical about preachers. He said, the only thing you need to know about God is you're not him. That'll preach, actually, very well. So God gives them that. And of course, they violate the boundary, but the boundary is necessary. It made it possible for Adam and Eve to recognize that God was not them. Of course, they ignored it, broke the commandment, they lost the boundary for a moment and tried to encompass the only thing in the garden that had not been given to them. In that sense, to become consumers of the garden. That no, I can have any, you can have it all. Yeah, it was the American paradise. Adam and Eve were tempted into the American dream. You can have it all. But it was also the equivalent of saying to God, you do not exist. Your boundaries make no difference to me. You are not there. Father Alexander Schmemann talks about this, that if you will, they broke the fast. The fast was as important as the feast. You know, why do we fast? I always have to drill with this for newcomers into the church. I tell people, Orthodox fasting is not about kosher. I mean, in my practice, for instance, how I deal with people, I tell them, if you're reading labels, you're doing it wrong. That's how I am. It's like, if you're looking for milk products, they're in everything in your grocery store. You won't be able to eat. Just don't read labels. If you're going to fast from the obvious, it'll be enough. Don't get silly. It's not about kosher. You know, it's not suddenly milk hasn't become unclean. That's not what we do. What we do, though, is we allow these boundaries into our life. You know, and I'm never even quite certain when someone comes to confession and said, I didn't fast this week. And I'm somewhat uncertain as a priest confessor, as in, is that a sin? I mean, it's laziness, it's sloppiness, and I'm not saying this to say don't keep the fast when, you know, Wednesday, Fridays, whatever's going on, but that it's something you're embracing freely as a gift to God, that you will acknowledge these things. It's not about, you know, like there's not a moral reason for not eating meat. There's nothing, Paul says, whether we eat meat or not, we're none the better. You know, there's nothing moral involved in it. You know, but if you don't want to keep the discipline, I mean, I think one of the problems is we turn things like that into moral, and then we become immoral about it. And it's like, don't do that. Just offer it to God. But I want to say, too, that I am purposely using the term boundary and boundaries in these talks, knowing that in doing it, I'm drawing from the language of modern psychology, even maybe modern pop psychology. But it's a good term. And it describes, I think, the essential purpose of the commandments and any number of things given to us in this life that function in this particular manner. Commandments, if I just used the word commandments, you'd go all legal in your head and start thinking in legal terms, and you just, it would, you know, so I like boundaries as a term. And I'm not saying it's not sin or things like that. It's just, I grew up surrounded by a lot of preaching about sin, and it didn't work. Yeah. So as in, if we can just scare people enough, then they'll behave themselves. It did not work. You need something more than that. It's sort of like being married to a woman and thinking, if I'm not faithful to her, her daddy will shoot me. That will work for a while, but it's not enough to build, it's not the kind of basis to build a marriage. Marriage needs love, not fear. So I use this term boundary as perhaps a soft way of expressing these things. But I want to speak here tonight about certain boundaries in our church life. In the liturgy, how many of you here are converts to Orthodoxy? Not all, but a lot. Maybe the majority. Okay. Well, I know I'm among friends. So think with me, if you will, about your first visit to an Orthodox church. I mean, was it daunting? It kind of depends on the background you might have had. I mean, you come in, you see people crossing themselves for what or why we don't know, and the Orthodox do it a lot, like all the time, it seems. I mean, I was an Episcopalian. I was a high church Episcopalian. We crossed ourselves, you know, reservedly. But there were specific times we were trained. You do it now. You do it there. I remember visiting a church in Washington, D.C., St. Paul's on K Street. And it was a congregation that was strangely all men, like the whole church. And they seemed, yeah, it was peculiar. And I would say most of them seemed to be stricken with OCD. But everybody in the church crossed themselves at exactly the same time. I mean, when you're all at the head, all here, it was, and I just thought, golly gee, it's like the Stepford Wives or something, you know, gone to church. It was like robots or something. It's very peculiar. But you go to the Orthodox and you're just, everybody's crossing themselves all the time and you can't figure out what's going on. And I can give people reasons, but then I tell them, you know, you'll learn. I can't give you a book that tells you, I mean, I can find books that do that, and those are like robot Orthodoxy. But, you know, you come in, it was kind of daunting. There's candles, and you wonder, what are they for? How do you get them? These people seem to be buying them. And if you're a Protestant, that can be extremely offensive, as if they don't do weird stuff with money. They feel better about it. We tell them we're lighting candles for prosperity. We're not. No, that's a joke. Sorry, that's a bad joke. Oh. But, you know, where are the musical instruments? Sometimes there's just not any. What's with all the pictures? What's with those doors up front and people coming in and out? And what's that smell? I mean, all these things, if it's new to you. And in truth, what people encounter when they come into an Orthodox church is a place filled with boundaries. There's things to do, and there's rules. But the rules are rules in an Orthodox manner. It's not exactly a legal place, but there's ways to do it, right or wrong. I've learned over the years, is sort of like I look and I can see someone coming in and I think, they're foreign. I can tell they're not an Anglo, so they already look Orthodox, they're crossing themselves. I can tell they come to the icons. My Russians cross themselves like this, big, slow. And they stare at the icon. I had a Russian friend, Dmitry. I said, Dmitry, why do you Russians take so long to cross yourselves? And you stare at the icon. And he said, when you look at icon, you see icon. When I look at icon, I see God. And I thought, okay. You know, I was like, one-upped me there, you know, one-upped. But, then the Greeks come in and they cross themselves like this. St. John Chrysostom, writing in the 4th, 5th century, fussed at his congregation and said they crossed themselves like they were swatting flies. And I thought, that's what they were doing. They were still doing it then, which is to say, they've done that probably since, I don't know, the book of Acts, you know? But there's boundaries, and people come in, how do they find themselves? The Romanians are nicely in the middle somehow. I've noticed that, but we've got those three groups in our church. But you see these boundaries from the inside. Now that you are Orthodox, from the inside, none of this seems unusual, at least not anymore, but you have to think about what people are used to. If they've come from another Christian background, most likely they've never seen a church with anything like rules and boundaries within its building. Or at least the rules and boundaries that they've seen differ in no way than going to a play or to a show. You know how to act. I had a buddy of mine back in my High Church Anglican days, and all he had ever known was High Church Anglican. And when he took a call to a church in South Carolina and was invited to a minister's conference or something at a Baptist church, he called me up. He said, Stephen, what's with these Baptists? I said, what? He said, I went in. He said, I couldn't see an altar. I said, yeah. He said, I didn't know where to bow. He said, his description, I was just rolling on the floor when he finished, but it was like, we had an Orthodox couple went to a big, Romanian couple went to a large Presbyterian church in Knoxville. Some friends invited them, and they went in, and they said, it looked like a living room. And again, where was the altar? Where are the icons? I didn't know. To them, it was like going to a show with speakers and music and stuff. Nice speaker, nice music, but it wasn't church. And but you come in, and particularly with the altar, you know, this is, and I appreciate it. I looked at pictures before I wrote this part. You never quite know. Orthodoxy cheats sometimes, but you have a real iconostas there. And it does, you know, you can't see into the altar much. And I'm sure I know pretty much how it operates on a Sunday morning. In modern evangelical parlance, their churches will be described as seeker-friendly, by which is meant having as few boundaries as possible. Because boundaries make people uncomfortable. They're supposed to. I mean, a problem with Orthodoxy is when you've lost your discomfort. It's a great temptation for clergy to become so familiar with the altar that we've lost our awe. I know a priest buddy of mine down in Fort Worth, Texas, told me he started serving at age 4 with Archbishop Dimitri of blessed memory in the altar. He said the first time he was given a candle to carry, he said, and I was just shaking. He said, and the bishop said to him, "Don't ever lose your fear of God." He said, "I still think of that every time I vest to go into the altar, you know, of how I shook." You know, and you, there's things with that that we have to work with. Father Maximus Konstas at Holy Cross has said in his book, The Art of Seeing, he said, only things that contradict, only things that contradict the mind are real. He said, there's no contradiction in what is imaginary. I mean, if I just sort of imagine something, there's nothing that, there's no boundary. It's just my imagination. You know, no boundary, nothing to bump into. The contradiction is when it's not what I thought it was, or it's not what I'm making it up to be. We do not live in a make-believe world. We live in a real world. Real worlds have boundaries. In the language of the church, we formally say that God is uncircumscribable, meaning you can't draw a line around him, right? But, which also means God cannot be pictured. But we say of Christ that in the incarnation, the uncircumscribable God became circumscribable. That as he became a man, he became, just as we can say of a man can be pictured, which is why we make icons of him, not just because we can, but because we can. It is a statement about what God and who, how he has made himself known. He is circumscribable. He is this and not that. He's not Jesus as you imagine him. He's not Jesus as we make him up. He is as he reveals himself. I mean, if there were only God, which is can be a very vague word, like the philosophers. I remember sitting in a freshman philosophy class in college, and our professor defining God, you know, all knowing, all, you know, powerful, all good, all this sort of stuff. And then he was going to blow our little minds out with introducing the problem of evil, and he created all of that problem and stuff. But that word God is so vague as to be actually meaningless. I can remember, particularly back in my Anglican past, it wasn't unusual to have these conversations. Sort of Advent was Christmas party time, and you go and there'd be cocktails, and you're sitting around sharing cocktails, and you know everybody who's had 3 cocktails becomes a theologian in the presence of a man wearing his dog collar, and so you know, and they'd come up and just what I want, you know, you're sloshed. And they say, and begin the conversation by saying, "Well, I believe that God dot dot dot," and then you'd hear all kinds of nonsense. But I got to where I kind of got meaner as the years went on, and I got to where I just interrupted them, and would say things like, "Excuse me, are you a prophet?" Or even this was. I guess I felt pretty secure in my job, saying, "Why do you believe that what you think about God matters? It actually doesn't matter what you think about God." And I'll say this as an Orthodox priest. Everything we know about God, we know through Jesus Christ. St. John writes and says, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." He has made him known. He has, literally in the Greek, it's the word that we get for exegesis. That is, he has interpreted him. If you want to know who God is, Jesus is the exegesis of the Father. You don't know God. You can't get behind Jesus to talk about God. You don't know who you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know anything. And It's a mistake that we tend to think we do. We can't get behind Jesus. And I have to say, I even have this bone to pick with those who, we've got them even in Orthodoxy, who want to start with the Old Testament and work their way towards Christ as if by reading the Old Testament alone, they know what they're talking about. No, they don't. The Old Testament can only, Christian-wise, be read through the eyes of the New. The disciples did not understand it until after the resurrection when it says Jesus opened their eyes in the book of Luke. He opened their eyes so that they could understand. And this is what we look for in the Old Testament, is looking for Christ, who is the face of God. He is God with boundaries. I mean, literally, I mean, if you look at the white wall here, there's no boundaries on the wall, you know. And if I said to you, well, we could use this imagination. Imagine, and I kind of describe an imaginary icon here, you know, but as I said, the imagination can't contradict, so you actually can't see anything. There's no lines or anything. It's only when someone brings out the chalk or the paintbrush or something and starts actually making marks, and the marks, if you will, contradict the white wall, that you begin to see something. These contradictions in our lives, these boundaries in our lives, are the means by which God makes himself known to us, the ultimate boundary, revealing boundary, being the incarnate God-man, Jesus Christ. Now, it's almost a running joke about the Orthodox, when people outside are talking about us, that they note that when we are being questioned about the Orthodox faith at some point, sometimes quickly, but almost always eventually, they'll run into the answer, it's a mystery, right? You know, it's like, it's, you know, and the less you know, the more you should say it. So anyway, it's a mystery. And they'll laugh about it and suggest that the Orthodox use or even abuse the word mystery as a way to avoid giving a straight answer. It's not entirely false. We do kind of cheat a little with it. But we often avoid giving a straight answer because the nature of true answers are often not straight. You know? I was sitting at a restaurant with a friend, and his son, who was a fresh graduate from law school, came and joined us, and we're sitting at table. And they were Catholic, actually. A young man was fresh out of law school, so he probably wasn't a very good Catholic. And we're sitting, you know, here, this little restaurant in Oak Ridge, and the boy says to me, he said, your church doesn't ordain women. I thought, I mean, it's like, oh, what a great opening line. I'm sorry, you know. Hi, I'm Father Stephen, you know. He said, your church doesn't ordain women. I said, yeah. He said, why? And I said to him, well, actually, I didn't say it was a mystery, but I told him, I said, probably you would need to be Orthodox for about 10 years and be bathed in the veneration of the Mother of God before we could begin to have a conversation on this topic, because it is as tied up in who the Mother of God is, which is the revelation also of what it means to be a woman. You know, it's like, I can't talk with some guy with a law degree about the nature of what it is to be male and female. I mean, what does he know? Constitution? Constitution doesn't know diddly about these great questions. It just doesn't. But I said, you can do that. Then I said to him, but, this was me being brave, I said, you don't know God. But if you would like to know him, come talk to me. I can show you God. It didn't work. But it seemed like the right approach of a way of talking about the mystery. It's like we think we can know everything, and these things, they are hidden so that they can be made known. But you can't get there. And I would even say some people, you know, just have opinions about things like, say, ordination. And they read a book, and they picked up opinions. And even if the opinions are orthodox, doesn't mean they know it. I mean, to know the thing is to know it into the depths of your being, for the mystery to be opening itself up to you so that you not only see that it is its boundary, but the boundary is revealing to you why it is so, what it's making known. You know, and other people will come at the boundary and say, you all worship the Virgin Mary. And I'm thinking, no, but it's close. And well, I don't usually get that scandalous about it, but the other thing I'd want to say is you don't know who you are. If you knew who you were and what God intends to do for you, what wonderful things that have not been yet made known to you that God intends for you. God became man so that man could become God. These mysteries of this. If you knew that, you wouldn't fuss at me because we venerate the Mother of God. We venerate her that we might know her. And it's, you know, and it takes years to know that. It takes years. I say it takes years. I'll give you that. This is one of my favorite East Tennessee stories. A Pentecostal woman I know had become Orthodox, and she was attending the Greek church in Chattanooga, and the Greek church had a very Greek priest in the old country, and he didn't know anything about American Protestantism, much less American Pentecostalism. But she said to him, I don't understand Mary. So he told her, go in the church and sit down in the pew in front of her icon for an hour. And then let's talk. That's all he said. And she told me, she said, so that's what I did. She goes, and at the end of the hour, I had no more questions. Well, I remember thinking at the time, because I was working hard, doing a lot of apologetics and explaining and teaching, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. You mean I can just put them down, plop them down in front of icons and that'll do it? You know, why am I talking so much? I wrote a book. I mean, what? You know, and I mean, I think the priest had a gift as well. But the inside of that, I had a woman who was coming to my church who was told me she was an atheist. But her husband was curious about Orthodoxy and they were coming. And she, you know, had plenty of all the arguments that people have about God and atheism and stuff. And she told me that one night they were there at Vespers and she was looking at the icon on the iconostasis of Christ and she said to him, why don't I know you? She said, and then I did. Well, you can't put that in an argument. You can't put that in something that would convince her of it. But the boundary that is the icon of Christ made it known. It revealed it. There are boundaries throughout the life of the church. There's boundaries in my life and yours. They ought to be there. And I'm going to go into a lot of depth about that tomorrow. One of the things, I'll say this just to give away a little bit about that. The emotion we have that signals a boundary is shame. It's particularly the form of shame called healthy shame, which is not, I mean, it's closer to something like embarrassment or whatever. I mean, you show up at a party and you haven't met anybody there, so you're feeling slightly awkward and you're looking around, perhaps thinking, am I dressed correctly? Am I wearing what other people are wearing? You know, how do people greet one another? Are they backslapping? Are they being very rigid? I mean, all of these questions that are going on in your mind, all of those questions are actually shame questions. They're questions that shame is asking. Clinical writers describe shame as the master emotion. It gives the other emotions permission. Like, before I start doing that, I check with shame to see if it's okay. One woman was talking to my wife a few weeks ago. She goes, Beth said, I hadn't seen you in church a few weeks. She said, well, I can't come. Every time I come, I cry. Thinking, my wife said, well, what do you think church is for? I mean, we come to church and we cry. I mean, it's like, but I know that boundary. I'm an Englishman, you know. Someone asked, why do we kiss icons? My convert's coming in. And I told him, well, it's because Jesus started with Greeks and Jews. And Greeks and Jews kiss stuff. And so that's why we kiss icons. If he had started with Englishmen, we would still have icons, but instead of kissing them, we'd simply feel awkward and apologize. And because that's kind of the English way. As a buddy of mine once said, if you've ever apologized to a piece of furniture, you might be English. So, but these boundaries, those are kind of internal boundaries, but these cultures have various shame things we do with this. But in a very healthy manner, shame signals that a boundary. Moses is on the mountaintop. God says from the bush, take off your shoes. Well, was there something intrinsic problem that God had about sandals? No. Moses needs to know, because the ground in which you're standing is holy. How do you know that? Because you can't wear shoes here. Yeah. Some of these things, I go to some of the homes, some of the Orthodox homes in my parish, I go to visit, and you open the door, they greet you, and you look, and there's a whole bunch of shoes in the foyer. And I think, Englishly, yeah, am I supposed to take off my shoes? Do I leave my socks on or not? How does this work? You know, and they usually just look at me and say, oh, it's okay, you're a priest. And I think, oh, holy shoes. But, you know, it's just these boundaries. And the boundaries let us know something. They reveal these things to us. The things that boundaries reveal to us are in the depths. They reveal deeper things to us. When we were first starting our mission, it was 23 years ago in Knoxville, we started in a living room, and then in a few weeks we went to a warehouse we rented. Had about a dozen people. We had a few icons and some of those music stands, you know, like the little wire music stands the kids use in high school. We had a couple of those, and we put just 8x10 icons on those, and those were our icons in a ugly warehouse. And so that's how we met. And when I converted, I had to give up my priesthood as an Anglican priest, and for the next 13 months, I was a layman. But as soon as I converted, Archbishop Dimitri blessed me to be the lay pastor of starting this mission. That was the plan, and we'll be training you, and we'll reordain you. So that's kind of how we were doing things. So I had a little table, not quite this small and stuff. It was a little table I had from home that I set out, and that's held my scriptures and service book so that I could, as kind of a reader, lead the service, such as it was. And we're making do, and there's a lot of making up as you go when you're in that situation, because there's not really a book for it. The horologion doesn't really imagine this as the case. But I've been doing that. And then one week, several guys decided that we needed an iconostasis. So one Saturday, they made a run to Lowe's and bought a bunch of lumber and some drywall and came back. And by the end of Saturday, they had built a wall 25 feet wide. The warehouse was 25 feet wide. They built a wall with three openings in it. The iconostasis that's now fancy wood with wonderful icons on it at St. Anne is 25 feet across. And the reason is because that's how wide the warehouse was originally. Long story. But they built this thing on a Saturday, and we hung an icon of Christ on, you know, in his place, an icon of the Mother of God in her place, and somehow or another, my little table had wound up on the altar side of the wall. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh my goodness, my table's an altar. This thing that I'd only been using to hold my book was now an altar. And that also kind of meant I could no longer use it as my table. It's the altar, because I couldn't stand in the altar and preside from there. We had just built a space that you couldn't go into. We had to wait for a priest to come to bless us to go in. So there we are. It's kind of like painting yourself into a corner or something, but we altered ourselves there in creating this boundary. One of the things that was interesting to me, and it was truly an eye-opener, was that I would have said before that, would have imagined that an iconostasis existed to hide something, when in fact it exists to reveal something. You know, there was no altar in the church until the iconostasis was put up. And when the iconostasis was up, suddenly you can see the altar. Suddenly, our warehouse was becoming a church. As primitive and ugly as it was becoming church. It was becoming a holy space. And it's interesting how that kind of thing began to act on people's lives. There is a, if you will, a preaching of the gospel by bringing these boundaries where people can see them and encounter them. I mean, you just go outside and go walking somewhere. Someone says, you know, I feel closer to God when I go walking in the woods. And I think, well, that's really great, but he's got an appointment to meet you at church on Sunday morning at 9:30. And you missed it. These boundaries matter. They're gifts to us. They're not there to constrain us. They're there because they're necessary. There's so many things in our lives, from the nature of our relationships with others that properly have boundaries. That, I mean, if you're, say, in relationship with a narcissist, narcissists classically don't recognize boundaries, and there's reasons why they can't. It's sort of shame-bound personalities, and it's too shameful to recognize the boundaries. But it's like, it's painful. They can't know you. I mean, no one can know you if they don't know your boundaries and even why they are important. You know, as you get to know someone, it's like, I've been married 46 years. My wife told me a story last year that blew me away. I found a poem in the kitchen about a tree, and she had it. I said, you know, and she had marks on it where she was working on memorizing the poem. And I said, and it was sort of a nondescript poem. I said, sweetie, why are you memorizing this poem about a tree? And she wound up telling me this story about a little tree that was growing in the sort of space between the curb and the sidewalk and the house where she was raised as a little girl in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And it was a little tree. And she loved that little tree. And she would go in and she would bring out a cup of water and she watered that little tree. And she kind of, that was something that kind of kept going on. And then something happened, and apparently her mother got rid of the tree because it was just like a weed tree, you know, not planted with any intentionality except in my wife's, but she has this, and I listened to her talk about that. We have a lemon tree that is close to a pet. I mean, in the winter, she brings it in. She takes it out. It gets these little leafy diseases, and she'll be out there washing every leaf on the tree. I'm thinking, gee, are you going to paint them in autumn or something? I mean, just, she takes care of this thing. And she told me about this poem and told me about this experience as a little girl, I realized this woman loves trees. I mean, not just that, they mean something to her. And I've been married to her at that point about 45 years, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I was about to find it out because I was almost going to violate the boundary related to the lemon tree. As in, you need to just give up on this thing. Every time I turn around, you're out there having to fix its leaves and stuff like that. And instead of like, this, it's one of her happy places. She wants to do that with the tree. And I didn't, now I know her better. And now I know why she likes trees, all trees, the way she does. She knows them. She knows them. She knows their leaves. She knows all kinds of things about them. She's wonderful to go on walks with. We'll talk about the trees. She likes the trees. You know, and it's, marriage should be like that. I probably should have asked these questions along. I didn't know to ask them. But these are the joys of getting to know one another. These are the joys that we come to in knowing God, that Christ makes known to us. I mean, I don't think we know anything until God tells us about it, you know. And that's a long, long, slow thing. It's a life thing. I've started doing my daily prayers now that I'm retired. We have an arboretum in Oak Ridge, and I go walking in the woods, and not because I'm closer to God, but because I'm closer to the trees. And I've got a thing that if the trees aren't anxious, why should I be? And some of the trees there are pretty neat. And trees do talk, but they're very slow when it comes to talking. And they'll long years to say things. Our churches, for instance, are built according to a pattern. It's not strict. We violate it. But altar, nave, narthex, this tripartite division of the church, is related to the temple. As God showed Moses a pattern that he said, you know, that's in the heavens. Build it like this. Build a temple like this. We reflect the temple. Macarius, who wrote the Macarian homilies, I don't think he's a saint, but of that period, Macarius said the human soul is a temple. And it has these same kind of divisions. I've used this in talking to teenagers. You have a holy place. Well, let's start with the narthex. I tell them, your narthex, that's the Walmart part of your soul. You know, you go to Walmart, it doesn't matter what you wear, apparently, especially in the South. And, you know, you go there and it's your happy people face, howdy, and talk to everybody. That's a very public kind of thing. Then the nave, this is a family space, which is really why the icons are, these are family pictures, you know, in the nave. And that's, like you say, your family space. And then there's the holy place, and this is in the very depths of your soul. This is where you go to talk to God. You, regardless of anything else, you serve as the priest in that place, with Christ, in the depths of the soul. That we alone can do that. The scripture calls it the priesthood of all believers, and we practice that as we make the offering of prayer and thanksgiving to God in the depths of our soul. But when I've talked to teenagers about this, I keep saying that you like, when it comes to the boundaries that the church teaches with how you use your body sexually, is if you use your Holy of Holies as a narthex, you will not be able to find yourself. I've had any number of experiences over the years as a confessor, that someone who's been too promiscuous then has difficulty trying to find the self. The self becomes difficult because it didn't have the boundaries. And so what's needed there is a healing, reestablishing of boundaries, building up that which had been broken down, and allowing what is special and holy and should be surrounded with boundaries to return to its proper status. God wants to do these things for us. These things reflect, even the church is given to us, I think, ultimately, to teach us about the structure of the soul, that we might enter in. St. Paul said, didn't you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit? You know, so we need to be able to enter into that place. These boundaries can teach us about that. Let's see, watching things, yeah. That's what I wanted to do with this first talk, a bit about boundaries. Introduced the word shame. I've just finished writing a book on shame and the spiritual life. I've been hacking away at it for actually about the last 10 years. I've thrown away 5 or 6 versions. And now there's one sitting with Ancient Faith that I like, so I think this, we'll see. I'm hoping they'll give me news soon. But so I'll talk much more about that. But I've done about a master's degree worth of reading on the clinical material, as well as looking at what the tradition has to say on that topic. But it frames many of the things that are true for us about boundaries. And they don't exist. God has no intention. Like Adam and Eve, he didn't try to shame them. They had shame. They hid from him. And God said, you know, why did you hide? They said, well, we heard you coming and we were naked, so we hid. And God says, who told you you were naked? Did you do what I told you not to do? He changes the conversation from a shame conversation in which they were just disappearing in themselves, hiding in the bushes, and he brings them out into their nakedness. Who told you you were naked? You know, who used this as a weapon on you? And not only that, but it says before they leave the garden, as they're expelled, he gave them garments of skin. I always think of those as like Flintstone outfits. Garments of skin to wear. The fathers did a lot of amazing commentary on the garments of skin, but he gives them these garments of skin. He covers them. And this will be a theme we'll look at tomorrow, I think in the first talk, of this theme of covering, that God covers us, covers us, covers us. He finds us, but he doesn't find us in order to expose us. He doesn't find us in order to hurt us. He finds us in order to heal us, so that, as St. John says, that when he appears, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. And so anyway, I've got some time for questions here, if there are any, or thoughts, or lightning fast repartee, whatever. And if anything was bothersome, forgive me. And I'll try to explain it if you ask me about it. Right, you know, another hand over there too, but yeah. Maybe I can't think that I've kind of built more on that, but it's there. You know, I guess one of the question would be, in dealing with God, are there things that bring you up short? I mean, boundaries that you've experienced. I was talking, you know, at dinner, my childhood as a little Baptist boy in South Carolina, and I joked and said it was my beige period because it was just. It was country Baptist, and there were no boundaries, and it was just no beauty. And then at age 15, my brother took me to an Episcopal church that was a magnificent church, and I'd never seen anything like that. And I'd never seen such beauty. I was from the wrong side of the tracks. I still think about that church a lot, and from time to time when I'm home, I go by and just visit. I mean, I don't go to services, but I go in because I... you know, in some very formative years in my teenage life, I met God there. He was very good to me. Yeah. So, you know, it's hard to judge a boundary, you know. But, yeah, you had a question. I couldn't think of a story that someone goes out sort of seeking God. That's close. Yeah, I think that's a good one. And I think she might have been seeking healing, you could say, and she got more than she knew, but because God is good. But that's a good story, and that's a good example. As I said, I asked, please, if you think of examples on that one, because I just couldn't think of any. But, yeah, it's not a big theme in the scriptures. It's almost like we run away more often. But he goes seeking us. I mean, you think of the story of the prodigal son. You know, the son's not really seeking the father when he comes back home. But it's really clear the father had been looking for him. You know, saw him when he was afar off. And the son's trying to do all this talk about how bad he's been, and the father's not even listening to him. He's just covering him, covering his shame, putting a ring on his finger, you know, killing a fatted calf. When I converted to the Orthodox Church, we were received on the Sunday of the prodigal son. And in a few days before that service, we were going to South Carolina to do that. A few days before that service, a member at my former Episcopal church shows up at my front door, knocks on the door, opening it up, and he's got a really large cooler on the front porch. And he told me that he had slaughtered a cow, butchered it, and he'd brought half of it to me. And I thought, I had no idea that I had any cow people in my Episcopal congregation. I just didn't think of them as ranchers in Tennessee. But apparently he had a little farm and did raise some cows. And he also had no idea that I'm heading into the Sunday of the prodigal son, you know, and I mean, because they don't have that Sunday there. But he brought me, and I came back in the house. My wife said, "Who was that?" And I told her who it was. She goes, "What did he want?" I said, "He brought me a calf, a slaughtered calf." I said, I was looking behind him to see if there was a ring and a robe. But it was just one of several things that happened at the time that to me were like God saying, "I know you're coming, you know, you're not making a mistake. Welcome home, welcome home." But I like that story. There are stories of seekers. The woman who scours her house looking for the coin. A merchant of fine pearls. You know, so there are stories, especially Jesus tells seeking stories as parables to us. But, yeah. Well, I'm not going to tamper with whatever your priest tells you to do. You know, I eat what's set before me as much as I can, so I just don't worry about that stuff. Now, I know people who do their best to wrangle invitations with unbelievers during Lent, you know. Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say is I don't think the sin is in the eating of the meat. The sin is just sort of saying this to God, you know. I have a woman friend who has a medical condition, and I'm her confessor, and have told her, your fast consists in giving thanks for whatever you eat. Because... I mean, if you knew her medical condition, believe me, she fasts on a daily basis on a level that none of us would ever dream of wanting to fast, you know. And so if you can bear such a thing with thanksgiving, you would have exceeded the fathers of the desert. And the fathers of the desert would tell you that. I believe that the most difficult fast of all is to give God thanks always and for all things. That is the most difficult fast. Very hard to do. But another question, maybe. Perhaps. Maybe I fed them with such a fire hose, Father, they can't think of anything, but... We have tomorrow. What time do we start tomorrow?
Yep.
Okay.
9:30.
Wait a minute, there's another one. Well, you know, Job is, first off, one of the things I kind of like about Job is all the complaining in that book. His joyous statement, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And he does get an answer to his question, just not an answer you would want. I mean, it's not a rational answer, like explaining the problem of pain, or the problem of good and evil, except that God is God. And I've known some people who do some deep wrestling. I mean, I've spent some time with what I call Ivans, you know, like Ivan Karamazov, who does the Grand Inquisitor and the chapter on rebellion in the Brothers Karamazov. And it's genius. In fact, it's an unbeliever's genius indicting God that Dostoevsky himself said he might have done too good a job writing it and regretted it because it's, you know. But I've spent some time with it, a lot of time with it, and gone deep with a few people who had more reason to complain. I mean, that were, say, people who were victims of abuse, terrible abuse. And I mean, such that you, anything you say is going to sound stupid and glib, you know, but staying with them long enough that they found some answers. I've seen some things with that. So I think Job may be one of the most profound books in the Old Testament. And one of the things I like to point out about Job is that the Bible is an unbelievably honest book. I mean, here is an embarrassing book. States the problem of evil, doesn't do a great job of solving it, but it admits it and it sticks it in there. And you can read it and just ponder along with Job and the rest of us until God appears and you get your answer or something. But, you know, and it's like the Bible's full of terrible, horrible stories about our ancestors in the faith. And I think that should prepare us for being Orthodox. I tell inquirers coming to the church that if you become Orthodox, you're being plunged into 2,000 years of a dysfunctional family. Really dysfunctional. I mean, several patriarchs are not in communion with each other, and one of them's killing the other one. I mean, what the heck is all that about? It's terrible, but it's pretty typical of our history. And I warn people, I said, if you want a really excellent church, be Protestant, because they reinvent them. And when they reinvent a new one, it's better than the last one. And the Orthodox, we never reinvent them. We just keep, I mean, the Church of Corinth is still there, and they're probably having the same problems. I mean, you know, and if you look at the book of Acts, it starts with the beginning. You know, they're arguing, Greeks and Jews were arguing about taking care of the widows. You're neglecting my mama and all of that. And that's how we get deacons. Because you take a look, the Jews were complaining. I mean, the Greeks were complaining about their widows being neglected. And if you look at the list of the seven men ordained deacon, they all have Greek names. There's not an Aramaic name among them. It's just Greeks. Stephen, Nicanor, and the others. Stephen, I know. Well, anyway. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. Oh, yes? Yeah.
So for the mentors working with women who, like you said, they have gone through a period in their life where they maybe need healing now for that person from their soul. So do you have resources that you would recommend, like a book or something that helps?
Well, I think it can be a very specialized ministry. We have a resource center in Oak Ridge that's a cooperative work between Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestants together, supporting women in crisis pregnancies. And it's a good ministry. I know of some online resources. I mean, for instance, for years, the church's prayers for miscarriage were not anything I would ever wanted to use with a woman for a miscarriage. And frankly, the struggles with abortion has raised the consciousness of the church in our time pastorally to think more carefully about what it's saying and doing. And so like in the OCA, I don't know elsewhere, but in the OCA, we rewrote services for miscarriage and for the death of an infant. One of the things I do with women of any time or whatever is if they're dealing with healing, say from an abortion or a miscarriage, I encourage them to name the child. And I commemorate the children in the liturgies, and we do prayers for them. I run into priests sometimes who'll say, tell me what I can't pray for. Like, you can't put those names on the discus. Only the Orthodox can get names on the discus. And I was taught differently by Father Tom Hopko when I asked him about this. And when I look at that, I just think Jesus on the cross prayed for the whole world. And in the liturgy, we offer this on behalf of all and for all and for the salvation and for the life of the world. And so Jesus commissioned us to go forth and to heal and to save. And so you got to do that. And I sometimes even, I talked to my bishop about this early on. And I said, if this is a problem, either A, don't ordain me, or B, pray for me. He said, I'll pray for you. But actually, he blessed what I do with that. But I think we need to, first off, abortion is not the name of a child. A child should have a name. So that we can pray, not just so that we can pray, but so that we can have a relationship. Our fifth child died in the sixth month of pregnancy. His name is Michael Seraphim. We gave him angel names because we thought he'll get to see a lot of them. But he's on the top of my list that I pray for every day, my son, Michael Seraphim. When my son, James, who's my junior, I'm James Stephen, he's my junior, when he was coming into the church, he came to me that night and said, Papa, I will always be your junior, but in my chrismation, can I carry one of my brother's names, and can I be chrismated James Seraphim, which he is. And we're in the South, so we'll do things like chrismate you with a double name, because that's how we do things sometimes. We don't always, but we will, at least I will, because I'm that guy. But, I mean, I think those kinds of resources are important. Nobody needs judgment or any of that. They need the healing. But this, I have found it very helpful thinking about the soul and this kind of construct. Not just that, but the difficulties, and I will get to this tomorrow especially. It's very, very hard to get to the deep heart that is the holy place within the soul. It's very difficult. I think getting to the very depths of God and getting to the very depths of the soul are of a piece. You do one, you do the other. And you can't do one without the other. And so, anyway, so he dwells there. So it's a good question. God bless the ministries and other things people have told me about. I'm just so glad that, I was up in Colorado earlier back in Lent. And at Father Evan Armitage's church, and they had a wonderful number of parish ministries. They were doing that were very innovative in terms of pastoral care, the people, supportive things for emotional health and things that way. And I mean, the traditional structures of our society disappeared a while back, and we live in a very, very broken world. And, in the 90s, when I was an Anglican and I was arguing in the sex wars, all about all of these things, it was kind of abstract. Now, you're really talking about family members. You're not talking about things. It's people you know, and you've got to talk about it in a way that we can deal with it. It doesn't change the church's teaching, and it won't, because that's not what they need. But It's softening hearts and realizing I've got to think of how to talk. This is somebody I love, and I may disagree with them. There's a couple of topics that I don't discuss with two of my children. I love them. I love them. But we've learned we're not ready to talk about that yet. It's okay. It's okay. Someday they'll go to heaven and know I'm right. Yeah. Well, they might have real good reasons. What do you do with people? What do you say to someone who questions the existence of hell? I mean, for me personally, I tell them, "Well, I've been there." You know, so there's a certain side of that that is there. The question is, do they not believe in hell, or do they not believe in the eternity of hell? Two different things. And as to the first one, I would just say, you know, existentially, we already know a lot about hell. Secondly, I can say, I feel confident myself in saying that Scripture says that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So that whatever hell is, it's not something God's trying to do to you. That's not a God problem, that's an us problem. Now, as to the other question of is there an end to it, there you get... as I'd like my archbishop says, and he follows the same as Metropolitan Callistus Ware does, who says we could hope for such a thing, because we can point to some, like, say, St. Isaac of Syria, who taught that, St. Gregory of Nyssa, who held that. I mean, there are great fathers who held that. But it's never been codified in the teaching of the church, and there's some who argue that some of the things put forward in the Fifth Ecumenical Council teach definitively about hell. And then there's arguments about that. My confessor, when I first entered the church, I appreciated what he said to me. This was he was a professor at St. Vlad's. He said to me, if you don't hope that there's an end to it, there's something wrong with your heart. He said, we have no authority to teach what hasn't been given to us. And so if somebody asks me about it, I say, I don't teach that because I have no authority to teach it. And if you ask me what's my opinion, I would say to the guy at the cocktail party, what does that matter? Who cares what I think? You know, I try when I write not to write about what I think, actually. I try to write about what I know, which is a terrible thing to say, but that's kind of what I try to do, which is why I only write about a few things. But, you know, will there be an end? What I know, I like St. Sophroni of Essex said, so long as there's one soul in hell, Jesus will be there with him. And my prayer is, Jesus, if I need to go to hell, you know, if I do. But all I ask of you is just don't leave me alone. That if you're with me, it'll be okay. Like Psalm 139, lo, if I descended to hell, thou art there. But what I hear when people talk about things like that, I wrote this recently too, when people talk about not believing in God, I said then, and I believe it, that this is not really someone talking about what they believe. They're really talking about a soul wound. And some people have been so abused with bad teachings of hell and bad presentations of God that they do well not to believe in it for a while, if they ever do. The mystery of suffering is not something to ever be talked about lightly. And there's people who talk about hell mostly like they're afraid someone's not going, you know? And I hear this a lot. I get this a lot of pain about that. David Bentley Hart is someone who's written very forcefully against the notion of hell. He's an Orthodox theologian, layman. I think he said too much. In other words, I don't think we have the authority to say what has not been said in a council. But if I'm sitting around talking with some other guys and one of them said, I just can't imagine that it lasts forever. And we're, few priests having a private conversation, I wouldn't go, and we think, yeah, I know. I mean, it's like, I find it, God created us for himself, St. Augustine said, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. And so all I can say is if there's a soul in hell, then it's restless. And if they're restless, then God hasn't quit. And he won't quit. I mean, who knows the end of the love of God? I don't. But I know the fullness of the mercy of Christ on the cross. So I walk very gingerly around that. I don't write on it much. I will say, oddly, that when I do blog on the topic, I get more views than any other topic. People really like hell a lot. And, you know, I was trained in systematic theology. One of the things that bothers me is that for some people, their entire scheme of salvation requires hell. And I just think that just doesn't sound right. It just doesn't sound right that somehow another, you can't know the love of God without hell. I don't think so. So anyway, I probably said too much, and y'all have to have like 3 weeks of sermons to fix all that. But, you know, you asked me and I answered, you know. I'll tell you what hell is. Alabama never loses. That's a Tennessee answer, so. Yes. Well, I mean, obviously the hardest thing to give thanks for is bad stuff. I think there's a mystery in that, and St. Maximus the Confessor said, he who understands the mystery of the cross understands all things. I think there's a lot of things about the depths of suffering and the mystery of suffering that we don't know. I tell people, if you want to have that conversation with God, stand in front of an icon of the cross, of Jesus on the cross, and have that conversation with Jesus on the cross. Because if you're not doing that, you might be talking to the wrong God. And that's been helpful to me. I believe, I mean, look, we just had, what, Thomas Sunday? You got the wounds in Jesus' hands, in his side. You notice they're still there after the resurrection. Jesus doesn't just shed them and think, well, I'm better now. You know, whew, glad that's over. No, Jesus, those wounds are my wounds, your wounds, our wounds. They're still his. So long as St. Paul said, if any member of the body suffers, the whole body suffers. And that certainly includes the head of the body, Christ. So so a lot of times when I give thanks, particularly giving thanks about bad things, I do it because I know the devil really, really doesn't like it. Because he won't give thanks. If he could give thanks, he could be saved, but he won't give thanks. And so that gets, it just, he won't give thanks. I part of what I believe I'm saying when I say to God, thank you for terrible things happening. And I would be very cautious where I said that. Like if I said that in front of the wrong people, they might take it the wrong way and make it sound like I didn't think suffering was serious and bad. And instead, I mean it very seriously. But that in saying that, I am, this is like the greatest song of thanksgiving I can imagine was the one sung by the three young men in the fiery furnace. I mean, they were just having a Pentecostal hoedown in the fire. They're just in there and, you know, bless the Lord, all ye works of the Lord, magnify and glorify him ever. They're just going on and on. Oh, ye snows and rain, just, you know, bless ye the Lord, and on it goes. And, you know, and they're just in the middle of the fire. My father-in-law, I mentioned ever so often, was a very radical Baptist who took certain verses of Scripture in their most literal possible way. And St. Paul's admonition to give God thanks always and for all things was one of his verses. And he was crazy about it. I mean, that man died thanking God for the cancer that killed him. But he told me his favorite word in all the Bible was in the book of Daniel, from the three young men who said to Nebuchadnezzar, "It will not fall down and worship you." And Nebuchadnezzar says, "You know, your God won't save you." And he said, "Our God is able to save. But if he doesn't save us," they said, "Nevertheless," that was my father-in-law's favorite word, "nevertheless, I will not bow down to your image." And I think there's something to me in giving thanks in the face of all things that is a nevertheless to the universe. I don't explain the universe, but I see Jesus. And when I see Jesus, I see God's great nevertheless. And that wrapped up in that is an answer to all of it. It's just the answer, it, to me, is beyond words, except to give thanks, you know. So, anyway. Well, we're going to go for it tonight, y'all. There's another whole day tomorrow. But, yeah. Yeah. Briefly, my best friend, he and I lived in a commune, and we were Jesus freaks, and we did some pretty crazy things, believe me. I won't tell you about those, but we wound up, we're in college together, and he came up to me in the library and hands me a book. It was almost like with a brown paper cover or so. I mean, you know, it was like sneaking you a book. And he says, "Stevie, you got to read this." I mean, you know, it's like a drug deal or something, you know? "Steve, you got to read this." It was Vladimir Lasky's Mystical Theology of the Eastern Church. I mean, I read it and my hair hurt. I mean, that's a very hard book. But I remember when I read it, I thought, oh, because he and I had some interesting conversations on the topic of divinization, which we were seeing in the scripture. And we were being told, stay away from that. And he gave me that. I read it actually and wept. I thought, oh my God, this is actually Orthodox theology. This was taught by the fathers. This Athanasius taught this stuff. And it was just glorious. That was my first taste of it. Not just that, but I also have to say, and it was Russian. And I acquired a kind of my Orthodoxy with a little Russian sauce. And I do, it's one of the things that breaks my heart to see America on a kind of a hate problem right now about Russia and Russian culture. I mean, places canceling a Tchaikovsky concert or, you know, a Dostoevsky classes because I really like those people. I mean, I know them and I love their heart. And they've taught me so much. They've suffered so much. And we've suffered so little. And we blame so well. God, what hypocrites we are. But nonetheless, it kind of came that way. And then I was a classics major, majoring in Greek and Latin. So I went to the Greek church and visited. I thought, oh, wow, they're actually using that Greek. But it you know, and for 20 years, if you know much about Anglicans, they're almost all hyphenated. You know, you got high church, low church, broad church, whatever. And, you know, so you kind of have a spirituality that's your hobby. And mine was Orthodoxy. And I would read it and think and read it and think. And I talked to a woman who had been an Anglican nun who'd become Orthodox. And I was talking to her about her journey. I'd met her at this monastery. And she listened to me ramble on like I'm doing now. And she said, "Stephen, you think a lot." She said, "Someday you'll think with your heart. And when you do, you'll be Orthodox." When I became Orthodox, I've said this, my first 10 years of Orthodoxy, about 10 of the most miserable years of my life. I mean, the Diocese of the South was suffering a terrible schism and things were awful going on. And I wasn't happy about it. It was all hard. It was difficult. The learning curve was vertical. You know, it was just hard. I just happened to believe it was the truth. And I just couldn't do anything else. You know, I couldn't. I mean, I had some notoriety as an Anglican, and there was a couple of newspaper guys wanted to do my story, my conversion. And I said, no, thank you. I said, I am entering the Orthodox Church as a penitent, not as a triumphant conservative. In fact, one of the things I'm really happy about in becoming Orthodox is I get to renounce being a conservative. Not meaning that I became a liberal, but those words don't have any meaning here. Just, I don't have to be that. As I say, I no longer had a church I needed to save. I now have a church that's saving me. So, that works. But, Father, would you close us with prayer?